But his superpower is his ability to connect with people. So he's one of those guys, within like 3 minutes of meeting him, you're like, I would die for this man. I love this man so much. He's fantastic.
Wow. How does he do that?
How does he...
How does he enable you, someone to connect with him so well?
He just really radiates, for lack of a better term, and I'm unsure if I can swear on this podcast, but he radiates that he gives a shit about you.
Like, I can't believe you said that word. Oh, Jared, what are we going to do? Edit that out.
Leave it in.
Oh, my gosh, Jared. This is so horrible. Wow, that challenges my faith. Okay, go ahead. Keep going.
I can see you quaking as your faith is challenged.
He gives a shit. That's the thing. Good.
Good to see you again, man. How you been?
I've been very good. Life has been fun, fine, and interesting. And how about you?
Good. Yeah, things are good, man. No complaints at all.
Still just rucking your noogies off?
Trying to. Yep, trying to. How about you?
I have not. I have not been doing any rucking. My main motivation for it is when I hunt, and I'm getting ready for hunting and everything. And I actually had to cancel and take a big financial hit on my elk hunt this year. I just had something I had to deal with. I had to cancel it, and so that just kind of threw me off. I'm working out real regularly, but the rucking aspect has not been happening.
Where was the hunt supposed to be?
Colorado.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, I had it was a horrible nightmare situation 2 years ago with me and my son. It's still haunting me. The last half hour of the last day, we're up at 13,000 feet. We ended up hiking this mountain 3 days out of four. And two massive bull elks come right up over the false summit. We didn't see them coming. Didn't know at all. We're up to the very top. And so we both, we timed our shots, both squeezed the trigger perfectly. Both of them went down, fell over that false summit. And mine, I made bad shot placement, and I should have just pumped more lead in him when he was lying down. And I didn't. He got up and walked to the trees and never saw him again. Horrible.
Jeez. Yeah. That sucks, man. That's terrible.
Horrible.
Yeah. That's no fun.
No,
it's a serious game.
It is, know? And you can only tell a story like that and have someone understand the gravity who's actually done something like that, which is you. So
yeah. I had a hunt this year that was I had a mule deer tag in Utah.
Same deal
like you though. I had to cancel it. I had something come up like right in the dead middle of the tag, and it was like I have to do this thing, and I was trying to, you know, orchestrate, okay, I'm going to fly here, and then I'm going to fly there, and then I'm going to rent a car, and I'm going to do that. And, like, you just have so many complications. I'm like, all right, we're just not hunting this year.
Right.
We're just going to have to sit this one out.
Right.
That's how life is.
Horrible. Well, hey, thanks for coming to Aggressive Life. If you haven't noticed, me and my guest today, we've got a little bit of things in common. We were both hunters. I read his book a number of years ago called The Comfort Crisis. Is fantastic. We had him on the show. It was one of my favorite guests. Right there, one of your favorite guests.
Yeah.
Especially because he had a whole chapter in his book about people who don't bathe.
Heck yeah.
They have unbelievable...
That's my favorite chapter.
...antibodies because they don't... Yeah, right. And yeah, actually, Dirt, you're never sick.
Not very often, yeah. So, what Michael says is true.
I know, it may be. It's good stuff.
There you go, man.
I know. And he's got it's called The Comfort Crisis. I'm going to get him to talk, just rehash The Comfort Crisis, and also talk about his new book, Scarcity Brain. He's an aggressive guy who I like to spend time with. So, hey, welcome to The Aggressive Life, Michael Easter.
Thank you for having me, man. It is good to be back. I can just feel the energy like eking over the Wi-Fi. It's awesome. I'm glad to be here.
I like it. Well, I liked when I saw you posted about our time together on your Instagram last time. And what you actually said was, you said, I actually enjoyed this one. Like there's other ones you don't enjoy.
There are, well, I would say I enjoy them all, but There are some that I enjoy far more than others, and that was one that I enjoy far more than others. It's good to be back, man.
Well, it's mutual. So give us a recap, because a lot of us have never heard of or read The Comfort Crisis. Just give us the recap. Give us your stump speech, like Comfort Crisis. What's the problem for us in America? What's behind that book?
Yeah, so the book is about really how, as the world has become more comfortable and easier in many different ways. For example, to get our food, we drive to the grocery store. We no longer hunt and gather. We have escalators everywhere. We have climate control. We interface with people over the phone and screens instead of in person. As those things have happened, it's been great, right? That's progress. But at the same time, that has had drawbacks. Because we, as humans, we are kind of wired to do the next easiest thing. And when you put us in an environment that's designed for ease, that backfires. So you look at, you know, why do we have such high rates of obesity and metabolic problems and even mental health problems? And I argue that it really goes back to the fact that we've engineered our world to be so comfortable, and we are paying the price for that.
Yeah, it's a big significant issue for us. And your stuff in the book was so good that I said, I got to make sure that I have this guy on the podcast, and you delivered. That was an unusual one. Sometimes I read a book that I really want to talk to the author about and they come on. Many times I have somebody on I know who has something to say. And when they say something, I figure out, I want to read more about that. And then I read afterwards. We had one of those guests recently, Nancy Cohn, wrote Forged in Crisis, Five Leaders Who... Are you familiar with the book?
No, but just the name, it sounds like something I'd like.
Yeah, it would be. It was fascinating. She goes into... her five leaders were... Oh, now I'm going to blow your mind. Ernest Shackleton. Do you know Ernest Shackleton?
Yeah, I do know
Shackleton.
Okay,
so you know that whole thing. Abraham Lincoln, some others. And I was so motivated when I heard her talk on the podcast. I said, okay, I just want to read the book. It's not a homework assignment. I just want to read the book. And so for you, I thought, I'm not going to read the book ahead of time. I'm going to have Michael talk about this, and I likely will, because I just read the precap that Dirt gave me. I thought, dag. That's good. So scarcity brain. Tell us about scarcity brain, Michael.
Scarcity brain basically looks at the question of, you know, everyone knows that everything is fine in moderation, and yet we all suck at moderation. And so why is that? It's like, why do people keep eating when they're full? Why do we keep buying more stuff on Amazon Prime when the average home has 10,000 to 50,000 items? That is a real stat. Why do we spend more time on screens flicking through whatever social media it is when we know it's making us miserable? It's like, why do we tend to overdo things in a way that hurts us in the long run? So I really sort of unpack that. And I think what makes the book timely is I really apply it to today, when we have more of all these things that we really needed to survive for a very long time: food, stuff, information, influence over other people. We have so much of them that we don't really have a governor on when we should stop, and that can hurt us in the long run. And I think technology is really changing that. So as part of the book, for example, I went to this casino laboratory in Las Vegas. So this is like a living, breathing casino, but it is used entirely for human behavior research. And I learned there sort of a lot of the underpinnings of how technology is really designed to capture our attention and push us to buy more, to eat more, and it's not always good for us.
So when you say scarcity brain, you're saying that our brain is wired for scarcity?
Yes. So we effectively are people who, we're very sensitive to scarcity cues. And a scarcity cue is basically like what a researcher would call a piece of information in our environment that makes us feel like we don't have enough of something. And so, for example, or that we're not living up to some standard. So for example, your neighbor pulls into his driveway with a brand new fancy car. You're like, oh man, I'm not making enough money.
I'm a loser.
Right? You go to the buffet and there's all this food everywhere. You're like, oh, I should definitely eat a ton of this, right? And just on and on and on. So scarcity cues, really, we sort of, they lead us to overdo things, really. And I think that kept us alive for most of time, because it really wasn't up until about 100 years ago that we had ample food, that we had ample information. Like one stat that really blew my mind about information is that the average person today sees more information in a single day than a person in the 1400s would have seen in their entire life.
Wow.
Yeah, just imagine the implications, right? And so, yeah, we're in a strange time. Like a lot of opportunity, right? It's a great time to be alive. At the same time, there are drawbacks to all this that we have.
So we're having to learn things and set disciplines in motion and restrain ourselves in ways that nobody in the history of the world in any corner of the globe ever has. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Exactly. I'll give you a good example. As I talked to a researcher who spent a lot of time with hunter-gatherer tribes, and he's out with this tribe in the jungle. They're walking around, and you know, for all of time, food was scarce. It was hard to come by. We had to hunt and gather it. We had to work for it. We never had enough. And he's with this tribe. They come upon this orange tree. They look at the orange tree and they're like, "Oh, this is amazing," because it's just packed with oranges. He's like, "This tribe, literally, these guys I was with, they sat down and they ate oranges until they puked. Mm. And then they continued to eat more oranges after they puked." And so, you know, that's really what life was like for all of time. And then you plop us into a world of, you know, 7-Elevens packed with aisles of ultra processed food and grocery stores and restaurants and all this. And it backfires, and it applies to our information ecosystem too, right? It's like you got ChatGPT, you got a billion results on Google, you've got social media coming at you 24/7. It applies to possessions. Like most people for most of the time, we only owned a handful of things.
Yes.
And those things were usually of utility. We would use them for a sort of larger purpose, right? We had tools that were passed down. And like I said in the beginning, the average house now has 10,000 to 50,000 items. We just buy and buy and buy. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but it ends up hurting us in the long run.
I grew up in a upper middle class household. My dad was a nuclear engineer, scientist, troubleshot nuclear reactors. And my parents both came from poverty. It was sort of the 1930s kind of poverty. They were, you know, homeless, but my mom had a dad who was a Methodist pastor, which meant back in those days that you actually didn't get much of a paycheck. People of the congregation would drop off chickens at your house and stuff. So she would always talk about the stories of sucking bones dry because they didn't have enough to eat for all the kids. And then my dad, just somewhat similar situation. So because of all of that, when we grew up, We lived a nice house. We lived in, you know, your basic suburbia outside of Pittsburgh. But, you know, my amount of presents I got under the Christmas tree was always less than anybody who was in my neighborhood. The things that I got for birthdays were always less than my cousins did, who came from houses where their dads were truck drivers or something like that. They just got more. My parents would put our stocking at Christmas, not like matchbox toys. They put in toothpaste, deodorant. At some point in my life went, wait a minute, you're trying to save on the family budget. Anyway, all that to say, my parents are wonderful. They paid for my college education, my seminary education. I'm very, very thankful for them, right? Just on some of those things, they were just really, really, really tight. And I've often wondered, do I buy as much stuff as I do because I was scarred when I was little that I just didn't have stuff? Am I sort of rebelling against that? Am I just enjoying it because I couldn't enjoy it before? I see something, I want it, I buy it. That's kind of what I do. And so I've wondered if it was kind of scarring from my childhood, but you're making me wonder, no, is it just sort of who I am as a human being? Is that what you're saying, that we're wired to consume now?
I think that most people most of the time are going to default to having more possessions rather than less. Because for most of time, that would help you survive, right? The tools you had were literally important for survival.
Right.
And so we are, and you know, and it's funny, you'll, you hear this idea that the sort of, you know, traditional people like native tribes, they didn't care about possessions. Everything was just peace and love and sharing. That's not true at all. Like, right. You know, there was a tribe in the Pacific Northwest, and literally these people would just make stuff and make stuff and make stuff. Like they really hoarded items as like we do today, having the Mercedes or whatever it is. It was a flex to have, like, I have 50 of this different type of spoon. I have 90 of this different type of knife. Like humans have always been doing this, but I think what makes right now unique is that, you know, after the Industrial Revolution, we could pump stuff out in mass quantities. It became way cheaper. And so now, for the first time ever in all of time, the average person can really buy tons and tons of stuff. Like the one stat I love from the from reporting the book is that it used to take the guys who would make nails, like literally construction nails, it would take them about 5 minutes to make a nail, a single nail. Now machines can pump out more than 100 nails in 1 minute. Mm. And so nails in the past were so hard to come by that arsonists used to literally burn down buildings to steal the nails.
Oh, come on. Are you serious?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
And so now we have Amazon where it's like, you can get anything you want for relatively cheap. It's going to be in your house in 24 to 48 hours. And the other thing that has changed, especially in the last, say, 10 years, is that if I wanted something in the year 2000, what did I have to do? I had to drive down to the store to buy it. I had to go, okay, I think I need this item. I'm going to go down to the store. I'm going to walk the aisles. I hope they have the thing. They may not have the thing. Whereas now, so there's a pause there. I had to be more intentional. Whereas now I just go, oh, Amazon, yeah, I'll get that right now. So I can fulfill, if I have this like little impulse of like, oh, that could be an interesting thing, I can just buy it right now and it'll show up. And then the other thing I'd add on top of that is algorithms have become so good at knowing what we want and will respond to, that it's like, I'll be flipping through Instagram. I'll give you an example. I'm a big fan of the Grateful Dead. Favorite band of all time.
Oh my gosh.
I've seen tons of
shows.
You finally
said something I don't understand and I think is ridiculous and stupid. Why?
I'm gonna send you a link. I'm gonna give you the red pill.
Okay.
Soon enough, you'll be coming out to Vegas for the shows at the Sphere.
I was just at the Sphere. I did. I'm not going. I'll go see the Eagles or you too. But no, I'm not seeing your freaking loser Grateful Dead headband. No.
All right, we'll see.
They don't even believe in electricity. What are you doing? What are they doing in the Sphere? Sphere's for artsy people. It's not for people who just want to get high all day.
Oh no. See, that's what you're missing.
Okay.
Is that the Dead, it was really in the 80s when they started to get like the drug people. But really what the band, if you look at their lyrics and the music, it's an adventure. Okay, so the lyrics really pull on like these ancient metaphors in myth, and like the lyrics are so deep. And the live shows, because every song is anew, they're improvising, each song becomes its own adventure. And so if you can start to sort of understand that, you go, oh, wow, like there's a lot going on here. So I would recommend you and anyone else who has an initial reaction of, I hate the Grateful Dead because of the Deadheads, I would suggest you watch the documentary on the band on Amazon Prime. I think it's called Long Strange Trip. It's by Scorsese. It's unbelievable.
Really? Okay.
It'll help you understand.
I'm in. Good. I'll check that out.
But that was a long that was a long diversion in order to tell you that. So when I'm on Instagram now, I'm flipping through. I see your posts. You're out doing cool things. I see, you know, my friend's post, whatever. I see a dog video. But then I get an ad, right? And it's like, here's this Grateful Dead t-shirt that like references something in Las Vegas too. And it's like pulling on all these things. And I'm like, this is like designed just for me. There was no one else in the world right. that would see this t-shirt and be like, I'm like, I have to buy this right away. Right. And so you can get these really hyper targeted ads that just, I think, lead us to spend a little more than maybe we want.
So this is really already giving me a bit of empathy, because I would be on the same train that probably you are of, why is America so obese? Why are we so in debt? Why are we so this, that? We can look at any social indicator that is negative and come to the conclusion that we're just not disciplined people, that we're just weenie losers who take the easy way out. And maybe that's true, but maybe Daniel Boone would have fallen prey to the same stuff as well. Maybe Harry Truman would have fallen the same stuff as well. Maybe George Washington, if he had all the food options that we had and all the spending options, because it's a human thing. It's not just a we're a loser thing. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, Daniel Boone would have had the sickest Kuyu hunting kit you've ever seen. So how I like to describe this is that the fact that, you know, you want to buy all this stuff, that you have a hard time saying no to pizza and ice cream, that you spend all this time on social media. I'm saying you, like the sort of royal you. It's not your fault, but it is your problem to solve. So you can't change the fact that, you know, that's kind of how humans are wired. And now we live in this society where we can sort of fulfill those impulses, but it does require building discipline to sort of start to unpack that and get around, okay, well, why am I doing this thing in the first place? And is this really in line with sort of my long-term goals, how I want to spend my time, how I want to spend my attention, my money, and ultimately live my life?
Yes. Yeah. So the 2%, tell us about the 2%.
Yeah. So 2%, it is my newsletter on Substack. We cover health, wellness. The name comes from a stat that found that 2% of people take the stairs when there is also an escalator available. 2%. Mm-hmm. Now, I would argue 100% of people know that taking the stairs would give them a better long-term return on their health, on their well-being. And yet 98% of people choose to do the easy, more comfortable thing that might actually end up hurting them in the long run. So the site really looks at what are ways that I can learn to embrace short-term discomfort in order to get a long-term benefit. And so I write about everything from nutrition to fitness to mindset to mental health to how we can improve our relationships, all these different topics, but ultimately interpret it through the lens of, like, if you want to improve your life today, you're going to have to do some hard things, right? I feel like the stairs are just a metaphor for right. for living well today.
Yeah, I don't mind when someone takes the escalator. I mind when someone stands on the escalator. You know, that was the inventor's dilemma when he saw the thing actually used in public for the first time. Did you know this?
No, I didn't know this.
Yeah, oh my gosh. So they invent this thing and he goes to see it in the real world, and he was stupefied that people were standing on it. He was intending that people would just have a quicker way to get up the next level. You would walk on the escalator. And he was like dumbfounded. Oh my gosh, so we just stand on it. It was meant to go things. Same with those moving sidewalks, right? I mean, they're meant so I get there faster, not I just sit there. So that's what bothers me about it. Like, just walk, especially going down. Like, if you don't want to go up because of knees, whatever, can't you walk down steps? Walk down the escalator? Happened last night. Came back from Vegas late because I can't get a direct flight out of Vegas to Cincinnati. It's just tough stuff. I'm on the top of this long-ass escalator. It's about 4 football fields long, it feels like. Stack of people in front of me, and I'm waiting. I can't. Sometimes if I'm late for something, I just kind of plot on the side. But I think I'm not really late. Well, it turns out I was, because the shuttle was coming. And actually, this was not in Cincinnati's airport. It was in Atlanta's airport. I'm sorry, because it wouldn't bother me. I've missed a shuttle in Cincinnati. I normally don't take it at all. But I missed, because I was waiting there, I missed the shuttle. I had to wait another 5 minutes or something like that. And we're very sedentary people.
And, you know, I think sometimes when I'll talk about this, people will kind of go, yeah, just taking the stairs, like, that's not really going to help, though. It's like, okay, well, there's actually research that shows that people who take just 5 flights of stairs a week they have a 30% lower risk of all-cause mortality,
really?
Which is basically a scientist's way of saying dying of any cause. So it's really, to me, it is, there is real power in just figuring out, how can I do what I'm already doing a little bit more challenging so I can get a better long-term return? Because every day in life, we face situations where it's like, I know I need to get to the second floor. I can do this easy, effortless thing that, yeah, it'll get me to the second floor, but it's not really going to give me all these other benefits, right? Or I can take the stairs. It's going to be a little bit more uncomfortable in the short term. But if I repeat that over the long haul, man, I'm going to end up so much farther in life than I would have been.
Right. So does the 2%, does that come to play in the scarcity brain, or is that a totally separate endeavor?
I think it does, in the sense that, you know, living well, that like, it's hard to resist buying the next thing. It's hard to resist the, you know, the ordering the salad instead of the pizza or whatever it might be. And so I think that it does apply in the sense that, you know, saying no to some of the amazing things in modern life, hard in the short term, but gives you benefits in the long run.
Well, there's also that thing that we're hardwired to consume. You know, that are you aware of the whole science behind the largest organ in your body that burns the most calories?
The brain?
Yeah, right. So our whole bodies are just wired to conserve energy, because for all of history, we had a hard time finding deer and finding calories. So when you find it, conserve calories. And so that brain is constantly trying to find shortcuts, constantly trying to understand things immediately, doesn't want complex problems because burns too much calories, doesn't want to hear a nuanced view, wants to be right or left, wants to, I got it, because the more you think, the more you're burning calories. So all of these things, I think, are interesting to point towards the reason why we just consume and eat and buy and spend. It's really odd. I don't know if we're going to get ahead of it to shorten our demise, because I don't know. We can't keep going like this, can we, Michael?
Well, what I think is interesting too is to go back to that casino laboratory. Is so in up until about 1980 in Las Vegas, and really across the world, no one played slot machines. Okay, they would sit in these corners of the casino. No one played them, and that's because they were boring. Then you have this guy come in the 80s, and he goes, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to digitize slot machines, and I'm going to really figure out the exact schedule of random rewards that I think will get people to play. Hmm. So what he does is he speeds up the gameplay, and he also creates this brilliant but totally wicked invention called losses disguised as wins. Hmm. So now if you play a slot machine and you bet a dollar, oftentimes you will quote unquote win 50 cents. And people, they've done studies on this, people, their brain reacts the same way as a true win. So what it does is it reinforces this constant play and repetition. And what then ends up happening after that sort of gets inserted, you see slot machines just take over Las Vegas casino floors. And now people today spend more money playing slot machines than we do on books, movies, and music combined.
Wow.
These things are just juggernauts. Like, people will play for hours and hours and hours, even though everyone knows the house always wins.
Right.
Once that happens, other industries start to go, wait a minute, what is happening in Las Vegas? How are they getting people to play these machines that they know are going to take their money in the long run? So this is when you start to see tech companies go, can we put that same sort of reward schedule in all sorts of different technology? So I call this this habit loop that was really first sharpened and discovered in slot machines, I call it the scarcity loop. So it's got these three different parts. It's got opportunity, unpredictable rewards, and quick repeatability. So with opportunity, you have an opportunity to get something of value. So in the case of the slot machine, it is money. Unpredictable rewards, you know you'll get that thing at some point if you just keep repeating this behavior. But you don't know when you'll get that valuable thing, and you don't know how valuable it'll be. So with the slot machine game, you could lose, you could win a dollar, you could win $100,000. And then three is quick repeatability. You can immediately repeat the behavior. So with slot machines, people just play over and over and over. But when you unpack those three parts, you start to see them in all sorts of different places in life today. So for example, social media. You got an opportunity to get likes, to maybe see some sort of content that's going to make you laugh. And so you're like, all right, I'm going to jump on this thing. But it's unpredictable, right? Mm-hmm. If you post, you don't know how many likes you're going to get. You could get two likes and you're like, oh, well, that kind of sucks. Or you could go viral, right? And all of a sudden your life changes overnight. Mm. And then what do? You check and recheck and recheck and recheck all day. You see it in shopping as well, where a lot of online retailers are sort of leveraging unpredictability in sales and bargains and using like gambling wheels to get a discount. And it's just this constant search. It's in so many different parts of our lives. And I think that that use of technology to really sharpen that three-part system has really led people into overdoing things, let's just say.
Yeah. So when I look at the comfort crisis, I had a real clear thing coming out of there, which was, hey, just embrace more doing hard things. And it's just good to be uncomfortable, even if it's a basic uncomfortable, like taking steps instead of the escalator or walking up the escalator, something like that. If I go and I read the scarcity brain, like what's the therefore? Therefore, spend less money. Therefore, eliminate social media and the gamifications of social media. Therefore, like what's the therefore on scarcity brain?
I think it's that you have to be aware of why you're doing things and how the cards are stacked against us today. And so the book really helps build the understanding that then can lead to the awareness so you can understand why you did the behavior in the first place. You can start to see yourself being pulled in, and that gives you optionality. Because I'll tell you this, you cannot really change a behavior unless you are aware of it. And usually by just becoming aware of a behavior, it often changes.
Yeah. It is. It is actually somewhat freeing to know that there's a system that's coming against me and I might not just be not as disciplined as I wish I was. It is kind of freeing. I'm just thinking and processing through your stuff. One of my, you know, my worldview as a Christian is formed in the Bible. And one of the things the Bible tells us is that, and this like never gets talked about. You know, it's just never anything that's ever on a street corner, some weirdo screaming it. But that we are adopted into the family of God. We're adopted. We're not born into it. We're adopted, which means something to me because I'm adopted. And so I always thought, okay, I'm adopted. Do I have an orphan mindset? An orphan mindset that means I've got to fight for the gruel inside of the orphanage. And this orphan mentality is actually a spiritual thing. It's why we're so at odds with one another. We're all fighting for recognition. We're all fighting for fairsies. We're all fighting to feel like we're loved because internally we don't feel like we're loved. We're judged constantly about how I'm competing, how I'm stacking up. And I think that's just a spiritual layer to what your research is about the scarcity. It's a scarcity mindset, the poverty mindset, the if I can get it, I've got to take it right now because there might not be enough. I'm just rambling now to see if you want to build on any of this stuff.
No, I think I agree. And in one of the chapters of the book, I actually lived at a Benedictine monastery in New Mexico for about a week. Mm-hmm. And what was so fascinating about that is that chapter really gets into happiness and what leads to happiness. So I think we kind of live in a world where, and I think this has probably been the case for all of time, where people ultimately just want to be happy, right? But the way we search for it, to your point, is we compare each other. We try and one-up each other. We try and get the new thing. We think that the next purchase, this is going to do it for me, right? If I buy this thing, like then I'll arrive. If I get this title, then I'll finally arrive. So I go to this monastery, and those monks do not live an easy life. They're up at 3:15 in the morning for prayer. They're in their chapel, I think it's seven times a day. I'm probably getting that number wrong. Yeah, it's a while since I was there.
That's about right.
Yeah, they're in there praying seven times a day. They eat a rather meager diet, right? They're like, they're growing a lot of their own food. They're told to don't eat too much. They spend a ton of time in silence. Like, there are periods where you don't talk. They are sort of disconnected from the World Wide Web. And it's, you know, it's social in the sense that they're there with other people, but they're not really deeply interacting. And they also do a ton of physical work all day, right? 4 hours of work a day. And you look at that lifestyle and you're like, oh man, that sounds hard and terrible. But when researchers study Benedictine monks, they find that they are on average significantly happier than the average person. Mm. And so to me, that this suggests that happiness is often found in the journey, and the journey is not always easy. It's dedicating yourself to something larger that goes beyond the next title, the next purchase, the next whatever it is. And I think that that's why Christianity, for those who really dedicate themselves to it and the bigger ideals, can be so powerful. Because I can't imagine it is easy to always do the thing that you know and that your faith teaches you is the right thing, because you're up against this sort of larger system and your own sort of internal drives. But the more you can seek that higher good, I think the better off you're going to be.
Well, and based into most religions, and certainly Christianity, is the value of sacrifice, you know, which dovetails really well into the whole scarcity brain. Just because I can have something doesn't mean I should have something. And at the same time, just because I could have something doesn't mean I shouldn't have something. Because we can go on the other side too, just totally, oh, no, if it makes me feel good, then God must not want me to have it. God doesn't want me to feel good. Nah, you're overreacting a little bit there, partner.
Yeah, I agree. And it's funny, the monks who I talked to all said the same thing. And part of St. Benedict, so he's in Italy, I believe it was, I'm going to get the year wrong, I believe it was the 1100s. And he goes up into, so he's born in Rome, and this is at a time when Rome has a ton of money. Everyone is, he says, Rome is dying in its laughs. So like, everyone is drinking, they're eating all the time, they got all this stuff. And he's like, I don't think this is it. And so what he does is he goes and he lives in a cave for 3 years. He meditates on God, on all these higher things. And his takeaway was, you know, I'm really glad that I did that, but I don't think that that's really necessary for us to get to a lot of higher truths. There is, in fact, like, finding the balance is that sort of the middle way, as Buddhists would call it, is sort of the secret. It's not going without so much that you cause yourself suffering, but it's also not leaning into the next purchase and having too much so that it causes suffering. And I think that that sort of middle path is probably different for everyone. And that's part of the hard work of figuring out, you know, where do you lie?
Are there any disciplines that you'd recommend for us on the scarcity brain? Anything that, hey, to get immune to the gamification of our money, do blank, or to, oh gosh, to lessen the impulse of X, do Y. Is there any, or is that stuff in the book, or do you have any you want to give us right off the top of your head?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in the book. So to avoid that loop that I told you about, you can change or remove any of its parts. So if I apply that to, let's say, shopping, one of the big things that leads people to buy more, like I mentioned earlier, is the speed at which we can buy. So if you can find ways to insert pause in purchases, whether that is, okay, I found this item online, I love it, I have to have it, but you know what? I'm going to put it in that cart and I'm going to wait 72 hours. And if in 72 hours I'm still as psyched for it, I will buy it. But if I'm not, then I'm not going to buy it. And I will tell you, doing that in my own life has probably reduced my purchases online by like 80%.
That's a great one.
Yeah, just inserting pause in any behavior can really, really help. I think with food is interesting because it's been engineered to be eaten as quick as possible. So I talked to this guy who's a junk food industry rep, and he basically said that if you want to get a junk food to sell, It's got to have three V's. It's got to have value, which is to say it's got to be cheap. It's got to have variety. So there's got to be a lot of different flavors, right? Sort of like random flavors. And then it's got to have velocity. It's got to be quick to eat. And so when you look at people who manage to sort of control their weight and eat in a way that improves their health, they're usually eating foods that have just one ingredient. They are not super fast to eat, because by eating foods that we would call whole foods or unprocessed foods, they're so much, it takes so much more time to eat them.
Chewing a steak is a lot of that burns calories right there.
Exactly. And so just by slowing that down, it effectively gives your stomach time to communicate to your brain, hey, we've had enough. Whereas if you're eating the same amount of calories in like Ho-Hos, it'll take you about 30 seconds to crush 700 calories in Ho-Hos, where with a steak, you'd be at that thing for 20 minutes.
Interesting. Right. And you're not getting that message to your brain fast enough on the Ho-Hos saying, hey, we've got enough calories here, boys.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, the eating one is just such a strange one to me. It just, you look at photos from America when I was growing up, just people at the beach, people, or they used to have this thing called the Presidential Physical Fitness Award.
Yeah.
And you look at those photos, or the dudes who were doing that, men, little boys and little girls, and man, we were a ripped culture back in the 70s, utterly ripped. And it's now crazy. You look at us now, it's like 70% of Americans couldn't pass the basic entrance requirements for the Army's boot camp.
Yeah, no way. I mean, I think that's actually young men that can't. I mean, it's not just average American. It's like a very specific.
Oh, is it? Okay.
From like 18 to 35, whatever the age ranges are. So it's crazy.
Yeah.
And I think it does go back to the fact that we have engineered physical activity out of our life. And meanwhile, we have inserted foods that are quick to eat. They're very calorie dense. And our portions have gotten crazy bigger. Like the average restaurant meal is now three times bigger than it was in 1960.
Mm. There was a book I read talking about your Benedictine experience called How the Benedictines Saved Civilization. Mm. And the premise of the book was that when the Dark Ages came in and everything started crumbling, the Benedictines said, or Benedict, he said, you know what? I am not going to delude myself to say I can stay inside of this culture and somehow survive. They removed themselves entirely from the culture, went out, start this monastery. People came to them. And the premise of this book was, when he did that in the Dark Ages, when things were crumbling, there was a burning, you know, a burning light, if you will, of people who had preserved culture and preserved society, who then were able to bring it back in. And the book is actually asking the question, is it really possible to coexist in the culture the way it is right now? Or do we need some people who just extract themselves entirely from the culture? That's a good question. And oftentimes that's being asked on grounds of, you know, morally or spiritually, but you're just saying basic emotional and physical survival. Can we actually survive in a cultural context that no one previously ever had to survive? And do we think we could keep just tweaking things, or might there be a more extreme out button we have to hit? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I will say, I think on an individual level, leading off of that, there is a case for the average person to take time, say once a year, to just totally get out and just remove yourself from the grid. So for you, that might be your hunting trips. For me, it's my hunting trips. Might be a long backpacking trip. It might be that you go, you know what? I'm renting a Airbnb that is totally off the grid in the woods for a week. And I'm just gonna like remove myself from society and use this to study, think about where my life is going, undergo a little bit of hardship.
Yep.
And then I think when you come back to normal life, it gives you a different perspective on how you were living. I think that can help you appreciate what we have now, but also use it in a way that is more helpful.
There's just too much, Michael. There's just too much. We can't deal with it. The stats are so clear. You know, virtually every wellness stat is horrible and going down, from suicide to divorce to depression to mental health. We already talked about the obesity issue, and we're just not in shape. We're talking about buying things and our debt levels, and we're not even talking about the level of loneliness we have. We're not even talking about all of these things. And I think I used to be more prone to going, we're just not as disciplined as we should be. And I think that's true, but I think it's more that no culture could exist inside of our current cultural context. There's just too much temptation. There's just too much immediacy. There's just too much sinister planning behind getting us to fail. When you've got the fast food industry that knows what their three V's are, when you've got the gaming industry that knows how to get us to win money when we're losing, and then all businesses are replicating that. We replicated that, by the way, in our church. We have an app, a spiritual fitness app, and we made sure we could gamify it for that very, very reason. Like, there's just too much for the average person to be able to say no to. I don't know if it's possible, man. I don't think it clicked with me entirely until I started hearing you talk that, man, this is worse than I thought it was.
Yeah, but I think to your point about your app, so if I download DraftKings and it starts gamifying me betting on all these insane football parlays that have zero chance of winning.
Yeah.
And by the way, that is happening. Whereas if I go on your app where you are gamifying me getting into larger ideas that are forcing me to ask hard questions, that are forcing me to find some sort of higher power in my life, I think that is a good use of that tool. I'll give you another example from the book that I absolutely just loved. So and you'll laugh at first about this. So the app Pokemon Go. Yeah, you remember that one?
I'm laughing already. Yes, I remember Pokemon. Yes.
So I had that when this comes out. I was living in New York City, and there's all these people walking around, like looking at their phone, whatever. And I'm like, what are these dorks doing? Like, this is. Then I talked to the guy who invented the app. So, what this guy, his background is, he was sort of the lead on Google Earth and Google Maps. And he had grown up in Texas. And as a kid, he was in 4-H. He was always outside doing all this. You know, he was moving around. He was with other people. He was playing sports, outdoorsy. But he also grew up coding and loving video games. And the balance of those two, he noticed, like, it was good to have the outdoor time, the physical time. Then he ends up having a kid, and his son is super into video games. But he's not getting the outdoor time, the time with other people. So he goes, all right, how can I give him this thing that he loves, which is video games, but put it in the context where he's going to get time outdoors, time being physically active, time with other people? And so what he does is he invents Pokemon Go. So the idea is, okay, I'm playing this game, but how do I play it? I have to walk these really far distances to find these Pokemon. While I'm doing that, I'm outdoors. By the way, if you want to get a really good Pokemon, you got to team up with your friends and hang out with them.
Interesting.
And so to me, that's one of these examples where he's effectively found a way to gamify outdoor time, physical activity, and building friendships, which I'm like, I'm all for that.
I like
so
that.
How can we use this sort of technology in a way that helps people in the long run rather than hurts them?
I love that. I had no idea that was what's going on with Pokemon. So that's totally cool. And I don't feel guilty or dirty for us gamifying a spiritual fitness app. But what I'm saying is, back to, you know, the first time in human history, spiritually, I mean, I read the Bible, it tells me there's a spiritual system at work in the world that's trying to hurt me. Okay, that's for everybody all the time. But what you and I are talking about right now, there's now systems that have never been there before. Like, well, there's systems now that we're having to deal with in the last 30 years that no human being ever did. No one ever came under a system of gamification. They never did that. You got up, you took care of your chickens, you killed something, you picked some vegetables. You weren't under something. Nobody ever had to be tempted 24/7 to spend money. That never happened. Mm-hmm. Just these things that we have are, we've got to recognize, again, we're not equipped for this. Maybe as we quote unquote evolve, and however many generations we do, we'll be more equipped for it. But we're just not equipped for the world the way it is right now.
Yeah, I think it's hard. There's a lot of chips stacked against us. One thing I'll add too is that, so numbers are rather new in the grand scheme of time and space. So for most of time, people could count up to three, and then any other quantitative distinctions were smaller, medium, larger. Once we build a full set of numbers, it allows us to start measuring things. And numbers allow us to be precise. They give us sort of clarity. So for example, I know that $50,000 is more than $60,000 because I can see the bigger number. But once we start putting numbers on behaviors like scoring things, racking up a certain number of likes, buying a certain item that we know is more expensive because that connotates some sort of status, those numbers can sort of capture what we value. And so we start to value the number and seeing that number change and get to a place where we want, rather than what the number represents in a larger sense. So I'll use the example of your spiritual app. The point of the app is not to score the point. I don't know if you use a point system, but the point of the app is not to score a bunch of points on the app. The point of the number is to sort of indicate these larger spiritual goals that you are sort of striving for, but we oftentimes forget that. Mm-hmm. And so realizing, and I'll use the example of salary. People will get totally obsessed with having a larger salary, right? Because the number tells them they're doing the right thing, right? Society values the bigger salary. But then you have to unpack and go, well, what's the point of, what does the salary represent? What is the bigger meaning behind me getting a salary? Well, usually it's, okay, I can provide for my family. It'll allow me to spend more time with my family. It'll allow some sort of freedom to do all these things. But by chasing that bigger salary number, we often spend less time with our family. Yeah. We often do all these things that are at odds with what we wanted from that larger salary.
Yes.
So that's just sort of a long rambling way of saying, don't get captured by the number. Think about what the number represents from a larger perspective and make sure that you are chasing those things. And the number could move in any way, but as long as you are getting these larger things, that is really what I think we're after in life, not a number.
Yeah, that's a good word. Michael, you are a good enough communicator and you're interesting enough that I'm going to invite you into the lightning round. The lightning round is when I give you a sentence and you have to answer like lightning fast. Are you up for the lightning round, Michael Easter of the Comfort Crisis Scarcity Brain and 2%er?
I'm so ready. I can feel the lightning storm just brewing above me.
All right. First is this. Lowest hanging fruit to join the 2% club.
Take the stairs and use that as a metaphor for everything else you do in life.
Good. Great job. Next big thing for you personally.
I'm building the 2% newsletter on Substack. That has been exceedingly rewarding and fun. And we've got an amazing group of people who are part of the community there.
As an outdoor enthusiast, what trip do you have coming up that you're most excited about?
900 mile hike in southern Utah this spring.
Wow. Well, first of all, you obey these rules of the lightning round perfectly well. You're just like, is he dirty? He's good. He's a rule. Michael Easter's a rule follower.
Michael Easter's killing it.
He's not one sentence every time.
Boom.
Very impressive. But I get to ask and make the answer longer if it could be. 900. So tell us about 900. What is it? What's the plan there?
I'm working on a third book. This is a longer term project. And like the Comfort Crisis, how I spent the 30 days in the Arctic is the sort of through line to that book. This will be the through line to my third book. And so it's a trail called the Hayduke Trail. Trail is a little bit of a misnomer. It's more of a route, but you basically start in Arches National Park. You wind your sort of way down to the Grand Canyon, and then you end up in Zion, and it ends up being about 900 miles. So we're hoping to get it done in 45 days, but, you know.
That's a lot. 945 days. So let me just do my quick little math here. Is there talking about 20 miles a day?
Yeah, we're going to try and get 20 to 30 miles a day.
20 miles a day for, wow. Wow, that's serious. And are you backpacking the whole time?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a few, we'll probably cache a couple places. You hit a couple towns along the way that you can hitchhike into for resupplies. So,
Who's we? Who are you doing it with?
I'm doing it with my friend whose name is Matt Sherman. Matt Sherman is the most fascinating man who ever lived. So he's the longest serving person in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Huh. He was a sort of off the books diplomat that the U.S. government would effectively send in to negotiate with warlords and advise generals and do all these things. So I think he got to Iraq in 2003 thinking that he would spend 6 months, and he didn't leave until I think 2019. And he was in Afghanistan, and now he just does a lot of hiking. Doesn't have a home, doesn't have a car, just bounces around, hikes. He's a consultant for a sort of defense investment company, and just great guy.
How'd you get to know him?
There's a funny story too. So for my book Scarcity Brain, I spent some time in Baghdad investigating the drug trade, and as part of that, I kind of had to get like, learn all these skills for if you get kidnapped or, you know, things go wrong. And one of the resources I had was that I was given the number of this high-ranking government official in Iraq. And if things were to go wrong, I was to call that guy and I was to say 8 words. I know Matt Sherman and I'm in trouble. And that would set some things in motion to get me out of a tricky situation. So after I got that, I got those numbers from a CIA friend who knew Matt. And so then afterwards it's like, hey, you were my lifeline, Matt. Like, let's meet up and hang out. And we've just become really good friends. And he's, it's funny because people hear, oh, you're in these wars, you did all this stuff. And people picture like tattooed big Navy SEAL type. It's like, no. This guy is like, he looks like your accountant or something, but his superpower is his ability to connect with people. So he's one of those guys within like 3 minutes of meeting him, you're like, I would die for this man. I love this man so much. He's fantastic.
Wow. How does he do that?
How does he
enable you, someone to connect with him so well?
He gets people off guard. He just really radiates, for lack of a better term, and I'm unsure if I can swear on this podcast, but he radiates that he gives a shit about you.
Like, oh, I can't believe you said that word. Oh, Jared, what are we going to do? Edit that out.
Leave it in.
Oh, my gosh, Jared. This is so horrible. Wow. That challenges my faith. Okay, go ahead. Keep going.
I can see you quaking as your faith is challenged.
He gives a shit. That's the thing. Good.
Yeah, he gives a shit. He just knows how to talk to people. It's one of my favorite stories is we were in Normandy over the summer for the 80th anniversary of D-Day. We did this 50-mile ruck with the Go Ruck group. And we show up at this restaurant and like the entire world is descending onto Normandy. We go to this restaurant and we are trying to get 7 days of reservations for like 10 people. And the guy who runs the restaurant is like, just picture the most textbook, rude French restaurant owner. Just, bleh, bleh.
Yeah. Yes.
And we go in there. We had just seen him turn away some people for a reservation for lunch that day. And Matt's like, okay, I got this. I'll go talk to him. He starts talking to the guy. Within like 30 seconds, the guy starts cracking a smile. Within like 2 minutes, they're laughing together. Within 3 minutes, they're shaking hands and hugging. And Matt just goes back and goes, yeah, I got his reservations for all 7 nights. It was unbelievable.
Wow,
unbelievable.
That's amazing. Michael, I always love spending time with you. We got to figure out how to do this without you writing a book, because I can't just have conversation with you when you write books. You're not going to write one every single year, are you?
No, that would drive me crazy. Although I would like to, but I'll avoid the insanity. But we'll just have to make this a regular thing.
I agree. Do you like the writing process?
Oh, I love it.
You do?
I love it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's kind of, it's a metaphor for a lot of things in life where you have this time early in the morning when you're writing and everything's going off the rails and you hate yourself and you're like, this is terrible. And then you pump out a paragraph that's just like so good. Mm. And it just is like, ah, that's why I do this, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's good. I like it.
And your 900-mile trek in Utah, though, is preparing you for your next project, right?
Correct.
Can you name what your next project is?
It's going to be sort of a follow-up to the Comfort Crisis, but more focused on mindset, mental health, giving a case for inserting more adventure into your life and how that can kind of be a solution to a lot of the problems that we've been talking about.
Love that. Michael, do you want to give anybody else a piece of info, how to find your stuff, how to find you? Like personally, I need to sign up for your newsletter. So just tell us how to do all that.
Yeah, if you go to TWOPCT.com, that is the website for the newsletter. You can sign up right there. And then I'm on all the socials and that sort of thing. But I would say the newsletter is probably the hub because I try and spend less rather than more time on social. I find the newsletter allows for deeper thinking. You can get into topics more. There's a good community. Everyone's positive. No one's a troll. So it's great.
Well, it's also your own platform that they can't take away from you and change the rules on you with.
Exactly. You know. Exactly.
Hey, everybody. I always like getting with this guy. I would maybe at this point I'll start saying, hey, he's not my guest. At some point I just start to claim him as some sort of friend. But I think we got a lot of stuff here. Man, I don't know what it is for you. Start getting less comfortable. Start just falling prey to whatever strategy it is to get you off your game and have you consume and consume and overspend and overeat and over everything that isn't healthy. Do something with this, everybody. This is not a podcast to think interesting thoughts. It's something to stimulate you to a better life. Go make yourself a better life. We'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life. Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and more at briantome.com. My new book, a 60-day devotional called The 5 Marks of a Man, 60 Days to a Powerful Life, along with all the other books in the 5 Marks library, are open right now on Amazon. Be sure to leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. Then send an email to dirt@briantome.com to get a free Aggressive Life sticker. Find more on Instagram @BrianTome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.